Hello. I'll try to speak loud and clearly so you can hear me. I wanted to hinge or base this walk that we're going to take around a question. And the question that I want to put forward, and I hope also that this tour will not just be me talking, but it will be somewhat of a conversation between us. And the question that I thought would be interesting to think about while we walk through the galleries is, what are kind of the main differences between modern and contemporary art and entertainment? And I've thought about this question, and I have some thoughts about it, but I'm also curious, just off the top of your head, do you see any major differences between modern and contemporary art and entertainment? Is there something very essential that divides the two?
Is there a difference between modern and contemporary?
No. I think that there is a difference probably in the time period. Contemporary is the moment now, and modern is, you know, something that led up to the contemporary time. But, yeah.
When did MoMA stop? And modern stop?
Oh, God. See, also, I have to say, I'm not a historian. I'm more kind of I can answer all these questions kind of philosophically, but not with kind of dates and all of, and footnotes. I'm not so strong at that.
When you talk about entertainment, do you mean the artist's entertainment?
Okay,
I thought I'd give you
an example. What is the difference between Snow White by Walt Disney or a Broadway musical and a work of art that's exhibited in these galleries?
Well, entertainment, of course, has a distinct play. It has a beginning, a time in time, and a definite period of time that it's going to be performed, or you're going to see it. If you're going to a theater or an opera or a concert, the art is continually. You can come back and revisit it or go to it and then see the rest of the scene and then go back again.
All right, I think that I think there are many differences probably, but this is probably something that leads me kind of to something that I thought as a difference for me between the two, and this really kind of has to do with what we expect from when we go to a Broadway musical and what we expect if we go to a gallery at MoMA. And I feel that, you know, entertainment is extremely strong and powerful at creating these illusions. You know, if you watch a movie, you end up having tears on your cheeks because you feel so touched by the illusion that is put forward by the movie. And then I feel that modern art and contemporary art oftentimes fails to create this illusion, or doesn't, in a way, modern and contemporary art disappoints the illusion or destroys illusions. And I'll say we get started with the walk, and I'll try to point out that's this observation on a number of the artworks. So first place we're going to go is the beginning of the painting and sculpture collection. Yeah, and then we'll meet in front of the work of Paul Cézanne.
Entertainment, but what about all art, all museums?
Yeah.
And the entertainment, where does the entertainment begin?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think people want to be entertained.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not. How does one define entertainment? Because
exactly.
When I think of entertainment, I think of something that's happy, yeah, as opposed to something that has a message. You know, it's like something can be entertaining, but it isn't necessarily something that's thought provoking. You know, when I think of it as entertaining, I think of it as
I don't think that at all, but a lot of people really do. We just saw a play called
25 questions.
No.
Oh, I did. I lost the last part of your.
I think that
comment.
I think an artwork is open more for interpretation by the viewer than a piece of entertainment that has a plot.
I agree, because it's probably emptier.
Right.
More of a container.
Okay.
So, one thing that complicates your question is that at the museum we have a really
fabulous film collections, and that includes films that were released for mass release, released for entertainment purposes, and we show them within, you know, our programming here at the museum in a way that kind of blends this question of entertainment. And so-called high art.
It's also really, it's really in a way theoretical, because I think these kind of expectations, they only exist in very few cases, like purely, and mostly it's a blend between the two works, kind of swim between these two polarities.
And that's the most interesting kind of work.
Who are we following?
Oh, right here. Yeah, we're right. This is where we stop. Here's the, you know, this is, to me, this is kind of the beginning point of the collection, the work of Paul Cézanne. And to me, this thought that I just tried to bring across to you is kind of exemplified in his work. Of course, this work has many layers and has many different qualities, but idea of creating a disconnection between the expectation of the viewer and then what's present in the artwork, I think, is also present in the work of Paul Cézanne, and especially in his landscape paintings, because I think in the 19th century there were expectations of what viewers could see in a landscape painting. For example, they could see a representation of nature, or a kind of the illusion of nature that manifested in a painting. And then if you moved on to Impressionism or something like that, it wasn't maybe the illusion, the perfect illusion of nature, but it was kind of the sensual the representation of the sensual experience of nature. And then in the work of Paul Cézanne, I don't think you have either one of that. I don't think you have the illusion of nature, and you don't have the representation of the sensual experience of nature. But what you have is... and in that way, I think he kind of disappoints some expectations that people had at that time. For example, also in his figurative paintings, I think some comments at the time that people had at that time was that the figures in his paintings looked disformed, or that they didn't look right. There was something wrong with their anatomy. And it was because Cézanne wasn't trying to represent the, you know, or create the illusion of a human being in the form of a painting, but he was trying to bring something else across, which I would say is the representation of the nature of painting. And that was, a big kind of disconnection between what viewer expected from a painting at that time. People really expected to experience nature in a painting, but then at that point, Paul Cézanne is, what you get is the experience of the painting itself. And to me, this is kind of it's a very theoretical thought, actually, but it's kind of the birth of this, all of this art practices that came after that.
Wasn't he also looking at it as like trying to think what the eye is seeing before the mind is really registering it as, that's really a tree, so it must look like something?
Uh-huh. So, I mean,
so he's really looking at his planes that you're seeing as that kind of thing, mm-hmm. too. So it's,
with, I think with all of these artworks, it's all of these artworks are complex and layered. And there's many ways how you can engage with them. And otherwise, they would just be these. Otherwise, they could have just written a piece of a note and hung it on the wall. This is what I want to tell you, I want to show you. But I think it's not... when you say about the visual, I doubt that it's really just referencing the visual experience of looking at nature either. Because he creates something like, for example, if you see that a lot of the shapes are created by black lines, if you look at the outside of the island, for example, there. And to me, a line is always represents abstraction and thought, because there are no lines in nature. If you look out the window, you will not see a single line. And by creating a landscape out of line, he's kind of constructing it. And that is, in my mind, abstraction and theoretical thought. Unless you have any comments or disagreements with me that you want to put forward, we can just continue moving. And the next group of works. There is a sculpture by Marcel Duchamp, and then there's a painting by Kazimir Malevich, and they hang right next to each other. And
someone said to me once, looking at a painting of a cat, and said, "This is art because I can recognize every hair."
I think some of the artists that are exhibited here would strongly disagree.
Would you agree on this?
No, absolutely not.
Maybe he loved his cat.
So the two artworks that I want us to look at is one, The Bicycle Wheel by Marcel Duchamp. It's here put up on the pedestal, and then the suprematist composition White on White by Kazimir Malevich on the wall over here. And maybe a question to all of you is, if we just kind of follow with this train of thought, do you think that there is an expectation or an illusion that these artworks try to subvert or, in a way, kind of destroy?
Destroy what?
Is there something in this? Let's take the bicycle wheel. This is a sculpture, all right? But sculpture had, there were certain ways how people thought about sculpture. At this, the date of this piece is 1915? Oh, yeah, but the original piece was made 1913. Okay. In 1913, people had, the general public, the art viewing public, had certain expectations of what manifests a sculpture. And then Marcel Duchamp put forward this object. And I think that there is certain expectations that were not met by this piece of object, or certain there's a kind of frustration that people maybe experienced when they saw this object. And what would you think is missing from what people expected a sculpture to be at that point in time, 1913? I think that's a very good point, the materiality of the piece, that this is ordinary materials. It's not precious materials. It's not a precious metal or...
The precious bicycle.
Processes. There's no physical process.
Yeah. The hand of the artist is kind of missing. We don't see the kind of wood carving or stone carving skill of the sculptor anymore. There's no hand of the artist visible. Yeah.
However, the life of the artist could be here and entwined with that.
Of course. This object, to me, represents a huge revolution in sculpture. And one is, you know, that the hand of the artist is all of a sudden gone. It's not about the hand of the artist. And I think I would even add on to it, there's... Even if people were already used to looking at abstract painting at that time, there would even be missing something from that, I think, if they looked at that, which is, this sculpture really just brings you back to itself. This sculpture doesn't transcend, and it doesn't offer any transcendence. You don't look at this and think about a landscape in the Provence. If you look at this, you think about a bicycle wheel and a chair and a stool. And that's exactly what's in front of you. So it's a sculpture that refers to itself rather than to some kind of greater idea or greater concept.
But not necessarily, because when you look at the shadow between made by that and the shovel, you have a bicycle.
Yeah. All right. Well, which is, again, you know, that an art work of art can be read in...
a specific installation that he intended it to be, though.
He might have used different lighting sources at that time.
I don't think even today a lot of people don't get it, but this is all about.
See, also my opinion is, I don't think it's this kind of dialogue that we're having is about getting it and not getting it. I don't think there is, personally, I never thought that there's anything that I couldn't get in a piece of art. It's really about this dialogue that you're having, the questions that you ask yourself when you see it. If you ask yourself one single question when you look at this piece, I think this piece already worked. It's about it's not about a specific question that this work wants to evoke in you, but about just the process of asking yourself questions or having thoughts?
I don't see it as a chair and a wheel, though. I see it as a vehicle to let my imagination run wild. Who was on that bicycle? Why is it on the chair? Was there a punishment? Mm-hmm. Was there a meal? I mean,
okay.
But it's so many thoughts.
Yeah. All right. I would say those are, I think, associations. We all have associations with everything. You can look at the lines in your hand, or you can look at a crack in a wall, and you will always have associations. That's just kind of how perception works. But then on the other hand, this doesn't, you know, if you compare it to the sculpture by Picasso, where he put the saddle of a bicycle and the... There he wanted to say this is the head of an animal. And here, this is not the head of an animal. And if that would have been his intention, he could have done a kind of more clearer job of telling us that this is an animal. But it's not an animal. It's a bicycle wheel.
But what a great result it is if someone said to him, said to a class, all right, use circles and lines. Now do something with it.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's a all of these things, I'm not kind of trying to be sarcastic about any of the artworks here. I think those are all major, major achievements. And we're, you know, lucky to be able to look at so many of them in like 45 minutes of walking through one single building.
You're saying the question matters, not the answer.
Yeah, that's kind of the question, I would say the dialogue. I mean, I'm in the practice of making these artworks, and I was so lucky to be able to share them with the public, you know, in places where I've shown them. And very quickly I realized that the artwork is really 50% of the equation. The other 50% is what the viewer brings to the artwork. And that's, you know, you always hope for the best, but that's really what completes the artwork. If nobody saw this piece, we wouldn't have to look at it. We wouldn't have to talk about it. Really, the kind of the dialogue between the viewers and this work made what made this work great.
So it had to go into a museum.
Sorry?
It had to go into a museum.
Very much. Very much. I mean, there's another kind of of other pieces too. He took also achievement, or one way how you can talk about his achievement is that he took something that was thought of as art unworthy or not an art object and put it in a museum in a way that we all looked at it as art.
It's sort of an irreverent portrait of a sculpture, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And in the time that it was created, I think was a time of... upsetment about the World War I period. And I think it's like a rupture of what people were expecting. So it's like, I don't know, a slap in the face in a way.
Mm-hmm.
This is art, he's saying. It doesn't necessarily have to be pretty or whatever it is in the past.
But it, on the other hand, it set the stage for generations of artists that came after him. I'd say we should move on. And why don't we go to the Brancusi fish? I think it's this way, yeah.
Dialogue when you make your own work, sort of a dialogue that might follow, or do you now think about your audience constructing your own work?
Yeah, very much. I mean, it's not necessarily about pleasing the audience, but just by kind of eliciting a response. To me, also the work of Constantine Brancusi has qualities that also subverted some prior notions of what makes an art object or a sculpture. And although, you know, I think all of us would say this is so aesthetically pleasing and kind of just a wonderful experience to look at, but there was actually, with him, there was a case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court or so, about his artwork, which pretty much put this struggle that people had with his work on paper, or they were created a record. And the court case was about another Brancusi sculpture that's also here. It's in on this pedestal with the other ones. It's the sculpture is called Bird in Flight, and there was a case, United States versus Constantin Brancusi, and the subject was the sculpture. And the and I think what's new about this kind of art is that also it was an expectation of art that an art object is art wherever it is. You can take it home, you can put it in a museum, you can. But with Brancusi, it doesn't quite work that way. And it happened when his sculpture got shipped from Romania to the United States, and the U.S. Customs opened the box, and they saw a piece of metal in there. And then they said, well, this is a very valuable metal, and you will have to pay a customs fee to import it into the United States. And then whatever museum imported that sculpture said, no, it's art. And then the customs said, no, it's metal. And then so there was this fight between the U.S. government and Brancusi, whether this is actually art or whether it's a piece of metal. And with this, I think, here it's, we wouldn't have that case today, for sure, but you can see kind of, if you take these pieces apart, they're really just, materials. And just by combining them and setting them up in a space, they become art. So art is, when you put a Rembrandt painting on a truck, it stays a Rembrandt painting. But if you put a Brancusi sculpture in a truck, it's not necessarily a Brancusi sculpture anymore. It's just the elements. And only when it's in the moment, in the context of the viewing space, does it become what it is supposed to be. And in that way, I think Brancusi also changed some of the expectations that we had towards a piece of art.
Oh, really? You think that?
Yeah.
All right, so have you ever seen Chihuly's large sculptures? And they come in a million pieces, and they come with a person who's going to put them together specifically for those pieces and unpack each one, put it exactly where it goes until it's, a million miles high. But still, it's a Chihuly. Mm-hmm. Even though it's in a million pieces, eventually it will be in one. But you would never say it's not a Chihuly, even piece by piece.
Mm-hmm. Even if you just looked at one piece in the box with the wrapping around it? Yeah, it's
would you? I mean, I.
If you put the Chihuly in 1930 and they unwrapped it, they might say, oh, it's a piece of glass.
I think it has to do with it being a piece of abstract sculpture as opposed to being a painting.
I mean, I could have said the same story. I could have made it probably even clearer with the Marcel Duchamp, is it called extension of a broken arm, the shovel that was suspended from the ceiling. If that's in your garage, it's a shovel. When it's here, it's a Duchamp sculpture.
So this could very well be a shopping mall sound.
Yeah, it could just be a rock in your garden,
Isn't that the problem Brancusi has, that he looks so slick and suburban?
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a problem. I think it's a really an achievement because it opens our eyes to kind of a quality that art has, that art is not only the object itself, art is also the context that it creates, the context which is the, people around it, the architecture surrounding it, all of that.
Is this a piece of art or sculpture? Are you thinking of it as a piece of art or sculpture?
I would say both.
Because when you compared it to a Rembrandt, that's, comparing it to a painting, which stays as it is.
Mm-hmm. But even with painting, it's, with Rembrandt is just... I love the work of Rembrandt, but if you look at a painting today, there is painting installations out of monochromatic color panels, and if they're shrink wrap on a truck, you wouldn't necessarily say that. People say this might just be the foundation of the painting. The painting has not been executed yet. But then when you see it in the space installed, then you see, then it kind of amounts to something else.
I was thinking about a similar question when we were at the Duchamp, because I think in those days, painting was sort of synonymous with art. You said art, people thought painting, and even today I think you say art, you say I'm an artist, everyone wants to know if you're a painter. And I feel like Duchamp and even Brancusi, by presenting their works, was sort of not an attack against painting, but showing that there was an alternative. I think Duchamp was more attacking painting because he was a painter before he started making the ready-mades, and Brancusi sort of coming at it from a different thing, but I think your question is really good about art versus painting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Duchamp, especially because he had been a painter, was attacking the idea of painting as the only art.
Mm-hmm. The time context is very important. When was this done? 1913? And I mean, this is now 90 years ago. And in the meantime, I mean, the eyes have developed. And we have moved on, so this looks to me a little dated and old fashioned.
Yeah. See, that's one way to look at it, but I think also it's for artists, I think it's very important to know where ideas come from, that we're not making this up because we're geniuses or so. No, because there has been a thought process going on for a long time, and that there were artists on the way, you know, contributing to this thought process.
It was then a break with tradition when this was created.
I want to continue with the work of someone who works kind of entirely different from the pieces that we just saw, and that's the sculptures of Alberto Giacometti, and they're one floor below.
Are you the artist that created the Simpson TV thing? I'm so happy to meet you. I was looking at my thing. Now, what is this artist thinking? But
now you know.
Well, I think as I looked at it, I realized that you were appropriating, which is one of the things that modern artists do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you were taking, you actually made the reaction, some of the reactions, more strong than they were when I saw them and while it was happening.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, but I'm so happy to meet you, because it's just...
Oh, I should have said,
nice to talk to somebody who actually did it, you know? So are you going to talk about it?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, hopefully, if I don't go too slow, like, I think I maybe have to edit my list of paintings that we look at. The work of Alberto Giacometti can be seen in two sections of the museum, and they're not together, and it's kind of also no coincidence that they're not together. He has kind of an earlier surrealist phase, and then he has this phase which brought out these sculptures. You can see it here, and the CD Square sculpture over here. And then also the portrait painting on the wall over here. The dog also, the dog is kind of, to me, it's kind of a hybrid between the two phases of his artistic production. But to me, his work is also incredibly thought-provoking. And again, with this thing about expectations, on the one hand, you know, Duchamp and Brancusi, they really played with the expectation of the viewer, but also I think artists have kind of had ideas about expectations of their work. Giacometti was already kind of an established surrealist sculptor, and then he started making sculptures like this, and it resulted in him being excluded from the surrealist circles, because surrealists were not allowed to use models in their artwork, and he used models to create these sculptures and these paintings. And so I think on the one hand, he disappointed the expectations that his fellow surrealists had of him, that, you know, art is these transcending images from your mind and that you cannot work from nature. But then I think even these sculptures and these drawings that he made, I think people still have a friction when they talk about them, because one thing that he said about these sculptures and these drawings is that he really just tries to make what he sees. And he said at that time he said some of his idols in his process were the painters that painted the movie posters at that time, for major Hollywood films or so. And it's very, I mean, people, I think when a lot of work that has been written about him call them like existentialist sculptures, and that may have to do with the time that they were made and kind of short after World War II, and he's a European artist. And that is, but I really kind of take his statement that he tries to do what he sees at face value. And I think oftentimes when we see a photorealist painting, then we are quick to say this photorealist painting shows us something the way it really looks like. But I think Giacometti really shows us the way things really look like. And it's kind of a shock to see that this is what we look like. But it's really true. I think with this city square sculpture, it's especially apparent. For example, when you try to... one thing that was in the first year that he made these sculptures, there's the anecdote that all of his sculptures fit into a matchbox. His whole production of 1 year fit into one matchbox. All these figures turned out extremely small. And I think it was really because we are really all incredibly small. I mean, we all know that I'm like 6 foot or something like this. But then, for example, if I made a sculpture of you, and if I really tried to make a sculpture of you, how I see you at this moment, and I made my pedestal with the clay, it was here, and I tried to represent what I'm seeing at the moment, you would be this big. And so he really kind of, it was a very accurate translation of what he saw. Like, if I made you 6 foot tall, I would really kind of not represent what I'm seeing. What I'm seeing is a person that is this big. And that's, I think, how sculptures turn out like this. And they're not miniatures. They're what he saw. He saw maybe sat in a coffee shop and looked at a city square, and he saw people are this big. And then also, I think there's a lot of information on a human body, and our brain kind of exaggerates this information because we know we have teeth and eyes and eyebrows and all these details. But these details, we don't... If you sit at a city square, you know that all these people walking around on the city square have two eyes, but you don't see their eyes. You just know they're there. And he wasn't making sculptures of the things that he knew. He made sculptures of the things that he saw, and there's a major difference. Another thing is that they were also incredibly thin. And it's really true. We are all incredibly thin. And it has to do with the contrast between the space that surrounds us and our own bodies. Even, you know, if you think of yourself as being a big person, your own mass is so much smaller than the space surrounding you. And it really kind of eats away from your... from the space you take up visually. And that if you really look at people walking on a street, they're really very thin. And also, even the color is kind of true. Like, people are very dark. Even white people are very dark. If you compare us to the color of the sky, we're all very dark. We're kind of non-reflectant and...
But I don't understand. We have a wheel here.
Okay.
We had a wheel upstairs. Why is he going back after Duchamp's wheel to this?
All right. I think about that too. Why did he not just, you know, put it on a the problem is always, I think, with sculpture is the, you know, gravity. He has to find some kind of a solution so this thing will actually stand. And then he created this wheel. It, you know, there might be some other connection that I don't know about, but I don't think it takes away from his statement that he tries to make sculptures of things that he sees.
Well, it said that he was briefly hospitalized, and it was his memory of the pharmacy part going by.
All right.
And he wanted to separate the part, and it's right there. He said wanted to separate what I remember. A human being is neither here nor there sometimes. Are they alive? Are they dead? Are they... and so that is what he's trying to represent, I think, with the sculpture perfectly centered in the middle of that pharmacy cart all by itself. You're so alone in a hospital, and you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that too philosophical?
I think it's that's something you can get from looking at the sculpture. It's an experience.
And people are so interesting. We just don't give them time to know what their heart and their soul and their mind is thinking. And so you look at them and you think, oh, that's all that there is to them. But they're so complicated. And they are, I think they're so big. I don't think they're so little in this world. I mean, yeah, really, you really are. But a person's mind and heart and soul can be terrifically huge. And you just have to
There's a way of reading this word. I think what you're doing is an interpretation, and people interpret work in many, many different ways. Comes from your thinking about work.
Well, if he's sitting in a cafe and he's looking at them, and they all look the same, I mean, he knows that they're not all the same.
But he's talking about the visual experience that he's having, and it's a very distinct visual experience. Okay, we have about 15 minutes left. Maybe we should go downstairs to Out of Time, to the installation of Martin Creed.
What do you think about this? Whole body stands on one foot.
I think also, I mean, it's also maybe kind of, but also what I say is, I think feet are incredibly big. When people make drawings, people usually make these like small, cute little things at the end of our bottom, but feet are really big. If our feet weren't big, we would all tip over. Yeah. I mean, there's other reasons why we don't tip over, but feet are big. Okay, so this is the work of Martin Creed, and the work is called Lights Turning On and Off. And it's in the permanent collection of MoMA. And I think there's another thing with, you know, maybe this piece also deals kind of with the expectation of what a collector or the administrator of a collection gets when they acquire a piece of art. I think in this, the lights were probably already here. And so it's really immaterial art and in a way. I mean, there's a timer, but the timer is probably not unique, you know, a unique work of art. What makes this work of art is not its material substance. And I think that's kind of also, you know, to this day, artworks try to challenge expectations of...
Would you call this a sculpture?
I'm not so good at finding these drawers where you can distinctly put pieces of art away in, but I call this an experience, you know. And I've seen this work in another group exhibition, and many people completely... I don't know if the sequence of the lights turning on and off is always the same, because I remember in this other exhibition where I saw it in San Francisco, I think a lot of people missed the piece. You know, they just thought something was wrong with the lights in one of the rooms. But yeah, okay.
But there are actually variations. There's 1 second version, and this is 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 5 seconds on, 5 seconds off. But there is another variation where it's 1 second on, 1 second off.
Yeah. And this is an edition piece of art? Yeah. So, for example, there's I don't know what the edition size of this is, but there's five of these, but not six. There's only five of them.
Five for five seconds.
I don't know. It's just a guess. And, yeah. And to me, we didn't look at it, but next to the Marcel Duchamp sculpture, there was a painting by Kazimir Malevich, suprematist composition, white on white. And to me, this is kind of, this is a sibling many, many years later.
How does this relate to your video?
All right. I think we can go over there and... This is called The Simpson Verdict, and it's a video I made in 2002, and I was very honored that it was placed in this, in the context of all the artwork that we just saw, and you know, this, especially this exhibition. And the question that was just put to me, how this relates to Martin Creed and other artworks we saw in the collection. And to me, there is a connection, and one, I mean, there's many connections. I wouldn't make this kind of work if I would not have known about all the artists that we just looked at. But also, I think the Simpson verdict itself, this verdict, has something that why I can only speculate, but why maybe a curator would be interested to place it next to other artworks, because I think the Simpson verdict has kind of the same quality, that this moment actually in time failed to meet certain expectations that people had, and it was very dramatic and very big in that way, because if you really think about what the verdict was not that he was innocent, and the verdict was not that he was guilty. The verdict was that he was not guilty. And in that way, he kind of, in that case, this verdict kind of fails to meet anyone's expectations. He wasn't declared innocent. He wasn't declared guilty. It was kind of, he was declared nothing. And that was a shock. And that nothing can be a shock is, I think, is amazing. But if you see, look at the work of Martin Creed, or if you look at the work of Kazimir Malevich, I think you can understand that nothing was a shock. I think people were shocked when they saw a white canvas, and people are shocked when they come into a room where the lights go on and off. Nothing can be extremely shocking.
Why did you pick this crucial moment in the whole trial?
I work with found source material, and the way I approach my source material is not that I go into a library and go through some microfiche catalog and find source material that attracts me, but it's more that I wake up in the morning and say, I would like to work with this and this source material, and you know, this is kind of the one moment that I remembered. I was not even a huge Simpson verdict follower. I just kind of caught it. I had just moved to the United States, and to me, honestly, it was kind of absurd that everyone spent their days following this trial on TV. But of course, this, you know, you just had to be present in this country and you remember this moment. It was just kind of like the birth of your first child or so. It kind of cut through everything.
It culminated. It was a climax of this whole process of the trial.
But then it's also, what's also interesting to me is that, you know, we're in New York right now and we're in America, and this event says so much about this society and this country. But also this, I had the chance to show this work in Asia and in Europe. And in Europe, for example, the recollection of this event is like that was an event that interrupted the 1994 World Cup soccer thing. And to them, they might know that O.J. Simpson was a former athlete, but that's usually as far as people get involved with his persona. And in China, where I showed the work, there was varying levels of knowledge of the event, but to some people, this was just kind of figurative, colorful animation. And I think, to me, this aspect of it is, you know, how shapes are defined by color, and this is as big a part of the piece as, you know, the event depicted.
Related to 9/11.
Did you see open the envelope and check the
whole U.S. society?
I think, you know, that's an interesting question. The question was, is this related to 9/11? The event is not related, but I think the work of all artists working right after 9/11 was kind of influenced by 9/11. It's not that it brought out some kind of emotional or political rage necessarily, but it just changed the position that artists were in. For example, in New York especially, after 9/11, art kind of, and the work of artists in a way became a non-factor for a little bit, and then the work of artists emerged again, but in a different way. People looked, I think it just changed the way people looked at art and the artists looked at their own work. And it changed the position that artists had themselves. And I think it's not, there's great minds that created a lot of the work in this exhibition. But if I think about myself, why this work ends up in this exhibition and in this building, it's not necessarily because of the mind that I carry around in my head, not only. I think it's just of the position. I feel that we all are in pretty kind of unique positions. I'm a half Japanese, half European that has lived in America since the 90s and that has been looking and working with video since then. And that's a kind of a position that makes my point of view different from yours, maybe. And I think in a way what you see is just kind of the position that I was in 2002.
I think the common thing is what hysteria is not objective. Yeah, hysteria here and hysteria after 9/11 was not objective. Solid.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we used up. Okay.
Did you have any part in the curating of this whole space?
I didn't curate the exhibition. One of the curators is here, if you ask about the experience that you had, I think it's very common. We just, when you put several works of art or several things in one room or in one experience, we make connections. You know, someone else will make different connections. Somebody will say, there's text here and there's text here, or there's, you know, there's dead people here and there were dead people somewhere else back there.
I have one question. Did you make these images intentionally very unemotional? Just reduce them to very simple shapes?
My kind of interest in making this kind of animation goes back to the work of Paul Cézanne. I'm really interested in the reality of images rather than the reality of reality, if there is such a thing anyway. I don't even try to bother to think that there is something like that. But I think that these images, these flat surfaces, they are kind of, we understand that this is supposed to be a person and with eyes and a mouth, but we experience them as images. The thing that I think with TV is so confusing about TV is people watch TV and they think they watch the event. They don't forget about that they're actually watching just a monitor with pixels on them. And what I like about animation is that people understand they're not actually watching reality. They're watching a mediation of reality. And that's why I think I came up with this style of drawing, because it expressed that this image reality is parallel to the other reality that we experience.
But you're using the real sound.
Yeah. That again has on the other, that I've thought about that. There's a long story, but I'll cut it very short. I think there's also in the use of sound in film, there's a ever since, for example, when sound film was invented, Charlie Chaplin and directors of his time were extremely frustrated because sound film, there was kind of immediately the need that sound and image need to match. And I don't think that sound and image need to match. And that's kind of why I thought the sound was perfectly fine, because in a way it doesn't match.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, how true were you to the video footage of the trial?
It's kind of like a translation. If you translate a text from English to French, I tried to stay as kind of close to the original as I could, but I had to take liberties because animation is a different language than, you know, camera-recorded footage.
I think that creates an interesting tension between the real soundtrack and the stylized images.
Yeah, would you return those to our show person here?
All right, I think we're at the end of the tour. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. Yeah.